The following message is by Pastor Steve Clark of the Evangelical Free Church of Salt Lake City. More information is available at our website, www.slcevfree.org.
Father, we are grateful for a chance here again to sit beneath your word and to be taught by you. Will you order our thinking? Would you order our focus and our understanding here? Would you teach? Our great need is to be taught by you and to hear your truth. And you have given us a great gift, your word in English, our language in print in front of us so that we can read it. But more than just words here, Lord, would you press these concepts into our minds and hearts and help us to feel them, to know them in our heads, but also to feel them in our hearts and to live resting in them. Today we look at something that is extremely important. Will you help us to hear it and understand it and to respond to it rightly, that we would be ready for it? So teach, Lord, this morning, we pray. Open up your word here and guide us in understanding and build your church for our good and for your glory. Thank you. Amen. Adjust the sound there. Yeah. Last week, our study of the Gospel of Matthew brought us to chapter 24, the long and heated confrontation between Jewish and the religious leaders finally had come to an end. Chapter 23, with his pronouncing of judgment over them. A judgment that would include the destruction of the city of Jerusalem itself and the temple within it. A judgment that he said would surely fall upon all of this generation, the people in front of him. He said that, and then he left. He walked out of the temple and walked out of the city and said goodbye to it. And as he walked out with his disciples following him, they left the city, they walked down into a short valley and then up eventually onto the Mount of Olives, just opposite the city. And as his disciples walked and followed him, they also were wondering because they were a little bit confused, curious as to what exactly and when. They asked him two questions. This was chapter 24, verse 3. You saw this last week. They asked him two questions. The first, all of this that you were just talking about, when is that going to happen? When is that going to be? First question, which he answered and we looked at last week in verses 4 to 35. And his answer was essentially that there would be a few preliminary events, some things leading up to eventually the Roman army besieging and destroying the city. That would happen in the lifetime of the listeners, so they could watch for that and they could detect some of the clues and then they could respond accordingly. We discussed this all last week, at least my perspective on it. This is a tricky passage, as we mentioned, and it's open to a number of different Christian interpretations. Some of the details are disputed. I gave my interpretation. We looked at it last week up through verse 35, the answer to the first question the disciples asked. But they also asked a second. And they asked, what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age? It's also a question about when, but it's phrased differently. As we noted, they asked that, as it's written there, it has a particular word in it that helps us differentiate between last week's first question and this week's second question. They asked about your coming, and they used a word that is different than just the ordinary word for transit from one place to another. You, over there, you come here. It's fine to translate this word. You could translate it come, but you could also translate it appear, your appearing. Saying it like that helps us keep clear of the difference here. They ask, secondly, when is your appearing and the close of the age? It's hard to know exactly what they were expecting at this moment in their confusion. They certainly view him as the Messiah, that's clear. They've come to that point. But how all of that is going to work out and how it's all going to be enacted, they're wondering. With this judgment coming on Jerusalem, maybe they're thinking that he'll come to the throne kind of like David did. David was anointed king, but then for a decade plus, kind of laid low in the wilderness while there was trouble in the land. And only then eventually did he appear in Hebron and then appear in Jerusalem as king. Maybe they're thinking it's kind of like that. Is it like that, Jesus, or something else? What are we to be looking for? What are the signs? What are the precursors? What are the clues? that you're going to appear, take the throne, and bring in the messianic age, the age of glory. That's their second question, which he now turns to in verse 36 with an answer that is different than what they expected. He hinted at this answer already in 27:28, saw this last week. It'll be like a flash of lightning. My appearing, where he used that word there, when the Son of Man comes, it'll be like a flash of lightning, absolutely unexpected, but plain as day to everyone. And that word for appearing and that language and then that teaching all gets repeated today as he turns in verse 36 to answer this second question. So this section that we're going to look at today, it's different than the previous one. It's a whole lot less controversial. Not to say there's no controversy, but it's a whole lot less controversial. It's pretty straightforward. It has a simple basic point to it that is illustrated repeatedly with stories and parables, kind of driving this point home and revealing how one should respond to it. So we're going to read down through chapter 25, verse 13 this week, and then we'll pick up from there afterwards next week. Read from 36 to 25, verse 13. I'll read that, and then I'll draw two observations from it. So here's the passage, Matthew 24. But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father only. As were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have left his house, let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, in an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. At midnight there was a cry, here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered, truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. Matthew 24, 25. Two observations from this passage. Here's the first. We do not and cannot know anything about the timing of Jesus' return. We do not and cannot know anything about the timing of Jesus' return. In verse 36, it says, but concerning, that's the grammar that shifts our focus here, but concerning that day or that hour, no one knows. Unlike what Jesus was just saying with regards to the first question, no one knows the timing for this, not even the angels nor the Son, but only the Father. A sentence which, if we pause it for a second, think about this, as an aside, that's a sentence that sometimes is a little unsettling for Christians as they read it and actually think about it. It seems threatening because it seems that Jesus says that he doesn't know when he's returning. And we might think, wait a minute, I thought Jesus was God and therefore omniscient and knows everything. But here he says he doesn't know this. What is this? And sometimes Christians get a little bit unsettled, understandably, until you think about it a second time through, and then this actually should be tremendously reassuring, Christian, with regards to the doctrine of Christ, his nature, his being. Biblical Christianity teaches and believes that Jesus is one person in two natures. And those two natures are not somehow like commingled or mixed up and twisted to form some sort of a third nature, like red and blue, you know, makes purple or something like that. It's two distinct natures in one person. In this case, fully God, full honest divine nature, fully man, full honest human nature. Two natures. Is Jesus fully God? For real? Absolutely. He has said so, and he has shown so over and over again. It has been repeatedly shown to us, not only in what he does and the great power he has over weather, the power over demons, the power to heal disease. The demons himself acknowledge that he is God. And he's also shown us repeatedly that he knows everything. He knows what's going to happen in the next 40 years regarding Jerusalem, as we just saw. And he also, for instance, knows diseases from a distance, like with the centurion's ill servant. He knows where he is, he knows what the problem is, and he heals it without even going there. Is he fully God? Yes. And, here's the point, Jesus the Son is fully man. And men are not omniscient. No honest-to-goodness man knows everything. Think about that. Thank goodness there are some verses in the Bible that teach us this, because if they weren't, we would have a whole bunch of verses that teach us that he's a man who knows everything, and that's not a man. He's a man. He grew in wisdom and in stature. When he was born, he didn't know everything. He had to learn. He was taught by the elders of Israel. He sat at their feet and learned things. Like people do. And here is an adult. He does not know when he is coming back. He's not some sort of a mixed third nature like a divine human or a human God. He is fully and honestly, absolutely God, and fully and honestly, absolutely man. Omniscient and learns. Both. Now, how those two natures go together? How do they exist two natures together in one person? I don't know. But that also is a good thing. If there was a God that you or I completely and fully understood how he is and what his nature is, he would be subject to us and beneath us, not the transcendent God of the Bible who made us and is above us and we cannot understand. People make gods they can understand. Things that even call themselves Christianity sometimes make gods they can understand. They make gods for men. This is not that. This is a God who is above us that we cannot understand. We are shown and we are told fully God and fully man. That's who Jesus is. That's all on a side. That's another topic. That's not what this is actually about. Here we have Jesus saying, I just got done telling you some of the basic markers and timing on the end of Jerusalem, the temple, and the old regime. But now he says, but with regard to the second question about when I'm returning, no one at all other than God the Father knows that. It'll be just like in the days of Noah, another time of great judgment. So, just like that, so will be the coming, the appearing, that's the word, the appearing of the Son of Man. Same phrase like up in 27, same phrase like down in verse 39. From now on, here on out, we are talking about his appearing. Whatever language we use, however it's phrased, we're talking about what we sometimes call his second coming, his return, his second advent, his coming again. All of that language now is what we're talking about. Jesus' return to earth. And no one knows, nor can tell, when that will be. On the contrary, normal life will be carrying on just like normal life carries on. Like what happened when the flood came, people were just doing what people do. Eating, drinking, marrying, going to work. And then Noah entered the ark. And then all God's people being finally secured, the judgment came and took away everyone else. No one knew it was coming until suddenly it came. That's the point made, but perhaps missing that, someone might say, well, surely Noah knew because he's building this ark. Or surely if somebody had watched and had watched the construction progressing and had noticed the gathering of the animals, they could have discerned some of the clues. That's not the point Jesus is making. The point he's making is that no one knew when it was going to fall. And just to be sure that we don't miss it, the two little illustrations in 40 and 41 make it clear. Two guys go to work. Two gals go to work. Why? Because it's Tuesday. And my shift starts at 8. So I'm going to work. They go to the field. They go to the grinding place. They're milling grain, and just like normal, that's what they're doing at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock, at 10 o'clock, at 11 o'clock, and 11:15. Whoa. Lightning flashes, and one is gone, and one is left. They both went, because neither one of them knew today, this morning, is the time, is the day, is the hour. Nobody knew. One's gone, one's left. In the context of all of the judged ones being taken away in the flood, probably the one taken away is the one condemned, and the one left is the one left alive. Jesus doesn't say, it doesn't really matter. The point is, two went, one of each. Neither one had any idea that 11:15 is the moment. They both went, they both carried on. And then it was all over to their total surprise, both of their total surprise to everyone. Same point made in verse 42. You do not know on what day your Lord is coming. 44. It is at an hour you do not expect. Verse 50. On a day when he does not expect him, at an hour he does not know. 25, verse 13, you know neither the day nor the hour. No one knows beforehand or can know when Christ will come and end this age to bring in the new one. But everyone will notice it immediately when it happens, like lightning flashing in the sky. That is all repeatedly driven home, verse after verse, by Jesus himself right here. What's the sign, Jesus, that you're about to appear and bring this all to a close? And his answer, there is no sign. After Jerusalem falls and the temple falls, the old regime is torn down. From that point on, at any moment, with no warning, there will be no discernible precursors and no hints and no yet-to-be-fulfilled requirements that will serve as some sort of a marker. None of that. I'll just show up. The next thing that happens is I appear. So stop and think about that for a second. Jesus could come at absolutely any minute. Before the end of this sentence, or before the end of this sentence, or before the, do you believe that? before the end of this sentence, or before the end of this sermon, or before sunfall, before sundown, at any moment, at any moment. Now, if I was a betting man, I wouldn't bet on any particular moment, but at any moment. Are you ready for that? That's where the second point takes us. That's the main thrust of this. Jesus is asked this by his disciples, and he's going to talk to his disciples about the importance of being ready for that. But I think we should probably stop here for a second and just hover over this and think about it. Most of what's going to happen in the next point, most where we're going to go on from this, is going to be about disciples, and it's going to talk about the importance of being ready, of living ready as a Christian disciple, prepared for his coming. That's who Jesus is talking to, but we also must notice that again and again and again, not as the main point, but every time as a side point, every time as a side point, there is repeated emphasis laid on other people who meet with catastrophe when he comes because they are not ready. So most is going to end up being about disciples, about Christians, but we need to think for a second about people who think they are fine. Perhaps you think you are fine and you aren't. Many people think they're fine because they think they are Christians. That's one of the repeated emphases in this passage. They think they're in the household. They think they're a faithful servant. They think they're Christians and they're in the community. They use the language. But he will say of those ones, like the bridegroom says in verse 12, "I don't know you. You're physically in this group, but I don't actually know you." People think they're fine because they think they're Christians mistakenly, or think they're fine because they're not Christians, but they're otherwise religious. They think there's other ways to be fine with God. Or they're not religious at all, but they think they're fine because they think, "I'm a pretty good person. I'm good enough." Or there isn't any judgment at all in the first place, so of course I'm fine. Or plenty of reasons, all kinds of reasons that many people think they're fine and do not give any thought of concern to what will happen to them when Jesus comes. What about you? This is not theory. This is not Christian truth. When Jesus comes to the earth to judge the entire earth, it is a universal encounter with the one true God. That means you. What will happen to you when Jesus comes again? He tells us all this and tells us this right now plainly because it is so real and so important. Everything about eternity hinges on this. The flood in Noah's day swept away most people who were just doing life and who hadn't been concerned to seek safety in God's one provided ark. There was only one way to avoid the judgment that was coming, and God put it right there in front of them with an open door for years as Noah built it, and most people ignored it. This is a symbol, a model of what Jesus and his cross is, the only shelter, the only way to be kept secure from the coming judgment, and God has provided it. It is right there in front of all of the world. You must trust him and get into Jesus like people had to get into the ark to avoid the coming judgment. Not physically into him, like physically into the ark, but into him, into relationship, into connection with him, united with him. How is that? That is by faith only, by faith alone. It's not just about knowing some facts or generally agreeing with them, sort of, But by knowing the facts and then seeing those facts mean that I am without hope in this world. The facts are that every single one of us, you, break God's law, break what God says, break what he requires by what you do and say and think and want, or by what you don't do and don't say and don't think and don't want. To honor him first above all things with everything we are, and to love our neighbors as ourselves, the summary of God's law, and no one does it. And no one can say, oh, I'm good enough. It's an absolute standard. It's good, righteous, or not, as in holy, pure, and perfect, or not. And the only hope, the only way to avoid the coming wrath against this rejection of God is to embrace what God's provided in Jesus' cross. That's the hope. The only way to be ready for his return, sudden as it will be, is to be a Christian, to be an honest, genuine, true Christian, one who trusts Christ's cross to pay for my sin, and that's it, just his cross. You need that before he comes, or he will shut the door to his kingdom feast like he shut the door on the ark, and you will be left out and taken away. Jesus does not tell us this now to condemn, but because now there is still hope. He hasn't come yet. Now's the day to enter. Now's the day to come. Today is the only day. You don't know if you have tomorrow. Today is the day to close with Jesus, to come to him, to trust him. There will be no time at the end to do what you refuse to do now, if you refuse to do it now. Five foolish girls said, no, we're not going to bother now. When he comes, then we'll go get what we need. And there was no time. They ran off to try to get ready, but it was too late and the door was shut. That is dreadful and coming. So don't put it off. Get ready now. Obviously, that is an important alert, an important warning to all of the world, to everyone who hears this and gives consideration to it. Jesus is returning, perhaps before the end of this sentence, or next year, or 10 years from now. I don't know. Are you ready? Are you a Christian, first off? But if you are a Christian, as I said, most of this is talking to those who are disciples and saying, there is something for us about readiness here. There is an alert to us here, an encouragement, a warning for us too. He's coming at a time we don't know. Are you ready, Christian? And that takes us to the second observation. Here it is. Be ready in wise, ordinary obedience from faith. Be ready in wise, ordinary obedience from faith. That's the point, although it may not seem like it at first, the ordinary obedience part. Because if you look at just verse 42 first, it says, therefore, since you do not know on what day or what hour or what minute your Lord is coming, therefore, stay awake. If the situation was like with a homeowner who knew somebody's going to come by and, you know, jiggle the door handle at 2:30. I could set my alarm for 2:25, get up, turn on the light, and be fine. But I don't know when that is. So I got to stay up all night. That's the situation. Got to stay up all night. We must be ready all the time. That's what stay awake is about, always being ready. That's appropriate given the reality. I have no idea when he's coming, and there's so much at stake, so we must always be ready. And in this brief parable, what the homeowner does is something that is extraordinary, something that alters what one would normally do at night. He stays up all night and does something that's really unusual, that is beyond what you would normally expect. And so it maybe seems that's what Jesus means. We should be doing something extraordinary, something that's beyond what you would normally expect. That's how we stay ready. Maybe, on the other hand, the parable of the 10 virgins, or the 10 young girls, that's all that word means in this context. The parable of the 10 young girls clarifies something else along these lines. It's important to realize. What he describes here is a relatively common situation. You got 10 young girls from the bridegroom's extended household. It would have been many families in his household. And 10 young girls that are forming some sort of a welcoming party after the bridegroom's marriage. He's expected to come back, probably with the bride, sometime after dark. So they're going to need some lamps, or literally it's torches. And torches would burn by burning oil that they were soaked in, so you need oil. Common. But only 5 of the 10 brought oil. Only 5 were wise and ready. Verse 5, though, he's delayed. Longer than expected. The night drags on. They become drowsy. And they all go to sleep. 5 were wise and ready and asleep, and 5 were unwise and unready and also asleep. They all slept. They all did the normal and expected common thing. They went to sleep when they were tired. Which helps us clarify something about being ready that should almost go without saying, but needs to be said. Being ready is in fact not about doing something abnormal, extraordinary, and unsustainable. Like staying up all night on high alert, on guard, neglecting the proper needed sleep you need. That's not what it's about. Or neglecting the proper needed food. Or never getting a job. Or never going to work. Or never saving money, or neglecting exercise, or neglecting health insurance, or neglecting home repairs, or all manner of things that one would not do if one knew that today is the day. If I knew he's coming back at 11:15, I'm not going to work at 8. Go to work at 8 every day. And save money for retirement. All manner of normal things. What I'm pushing on here is that there's a mistaken view out there that is more than just harmless error. It is actually destructive of the kind of life of rest, the kind of life of wisdom, and the kind of life of joy that God wants us to lead. And it's destructive because it neglects to build structures and to nurture roots that would sustain us and the church for the long run if and when it turns out we need to run longer than we thought. Maybe you've encountered this, maybe you've actually thought this at some point in your life. I tell this story every time I teach a membership class. I knew a guy that I deeply respect, and years ago, I knew a guy who said when he was in college in the 70s, there was a whole lot of talk about Jesus coming back soon and a whole lot of, and he said that it drove him and his friends to an inordinate amount of ministry and evangelism and outreach, and he said, because I don't want to get caught eating a bologna sandwich when Jesus comes back. Or I don't want to be squandering, I don't want to get caught doing, There's a whole view out there that's developed from another whole large Christian view on the return of Jesus that is all wrong. And it's destructive. Because in fact, what we're supposed to think about is not, I don't want to get caught, I don't want to do this, I don't want to waste this, but what we're supposed to think about is, I need to do the plain old ordinary obedience in life. Ready. Plain old ordinary obedience in life, ready. Those two things at once. They are not mutually exclusive. They are to be done together. And the next story, we've skipped over it. The parable in 45 and following helps clarify that for us. The middle parable, 45 to 51. Here's a faithful and wise servant that Jesus is talking about. The one that we all want to be. And notice 45 and 46, how flat out ordinary this guy's assignment and work is. Plain old ordinary. The setting is a servant in a household and given a very ordinary assignment by his departing master. I'm going to be gone for a while. I want you to assume some responsibility here to give to everyone their food at mealtime. How long are you going to be gone? A while. You don't know. But while I'm gone, as long as I'm gone, I want you to give them their food at mealtime. Maybe you'll have to think about that as it involved like preparing the food, setting the table, clearing the dishes, whatever. Just take care of meal. I'm going to be gone at lunchtime, so give them lunch. If I'm still gone at dinner, give them dinner. If I'm still gone the next day at breakfast, give them breakfast. 46, then. That's plain old ordinary work. Nothing fancy about that. 46 then, blessed is that servant whom the master will find so doing when he comes. Blessed, happy, fortunate, envied will be that servant who in plain old ordinary obedience did the plain old ordinary thing he was assigned to do. That's what wise readiness looks like, staying awake, alert. It is plain old ordinary obedience from faith. Key point, from faith. Within the story itself, this is implied. Why did he do what he was assigned? Because he believed what the master said, I'm going away, but I'm going to come back. Unlike the other servant who'd said, he ain't coming back. He believed he's coming back. And when he comes back, what is good and right and blessed for me is the reward that he will bring. Not what I can get here now, but he's coming back. And what he will bring is what I want, most want, where my life will be found. And believing that, he did the plain, old, ordinary thing that he was told to do. That's what the first servant responds. That's what he did, and what is desirable and envious about his situation is that he then was rewarded. I put you over all my possessions. When did it pay off for him? When he came back. Seeing that and believing that, he obeyed from faith. And on the other hand, the wicked servant said, forget it, it's been a while. Better get reward for myself now here. That's what the wicked servant did. Unbelief. He's not coming back. Whatever he brings is not worth it. What is worth it, what my life is found in, is what I have here and now. Let me get some of that. And it pursues this world. Physically part of the household, he was then rejected. This is so common. This parable right here. And I think as we read that parable, 45 to 51, as we read that right there, we could say, that sounds like a lot of what Jesus has said before. That parable could be in any other context. It is so common. From the promise that's coming, in faith in what's promised to come, I walk in obedience with him now. I obey from faith. That's how the Christian faith works. This is plain old ordinary assignment and plain old ordinary mechanism. I think, for me, what's special about it in this context, in the context of no one knows when he's coming, see if this works this way for you, is that I read this parable, I think about how I'm living by faith and the promises that are to come and the reward that is to come with it, and then I put it in this context about Jesus is coming before the end of this sentence, before the end of this sentence. And what it does is it calls to front of mind, oh yeah. Oh yeah. This is not it. This is not it. If you're a Christian, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. This is not it. Call it to front of mind. Oh yeah. He's coming. And will ask you, what did you do with the assignment? You'll give an account for that. When he comes, at any minute, blessed is the servant whose master finds him doing exactly what he was told to do. He comes into the room and he finds you with tray on your shoulder, serving off the dish. Well done, good and faithful servant. I'm not doing anything fancy. Right. You're doing exactly what I told you to do in faith. Blessed are you. That's not fancy. And you know that. Do you see it? For me, what it does for me is it brings us to front of mind. And maybe I could put it like this. Put it a different way. Are you right now thinking about his coming and living by faith obedient in all the ordinary things that come your way, eating or drinking or whatever you're doing it all to the glory of God? Or are you right now setting aside his coming and in all the ordinary things that come your way, living really as if this is all there is and you must find your best life now in the stuff that's in front of you, eating and drinking and whatever you're doing it all to the glory of you? Which is it? This pressed on, repeated, you don't know the moment. You don't know. There will be a moment when here he is. Not living, I don't want to get caught eating a bologna sandwich. Are you eating a bologna sandwich to the glory of God, or are you taking what's come to you, the food that you have in front of you, and using it to satisfy yourself? That's the question. Not what, how. Not this is wrong, but why am I doing it? For whose glory and honor? In whose service? That's the question that is really at the heart of readiness. Not am I doing something extraordinary, something unusual, something that is tip of your toe, leaning forward, but am I faithful, believing, and obedient? Which is it, Christian? When I work through this for myself, I find it, in a way, very familiar and in a way somewhat sharp. And I feel like I'm kind of missing the sharp here as I'm talking about this. So I'm just going to pray, Lord, make it sharp. A life that is constantly ready is a life of thinking, if I have to put this moment in front of him right now and answer the question, am I obedient from faith right now? What would my answer be? I'll have to give an account for this. You'll have to give an account for that moment. And that one. And that one. Blessed is the servant whose master finds him or her doing what you were supposed to do in faith when he comes. Is that you? Are you ready? Believe. Lord, help us to believe that you are coming. Believe. Help us to believe that when you come, you'll bring our lives with you, our life, our reward, our inheritance with you. Believe that this life is not where your life is. That's what wisdom, that's what readiness looks like. May God open our eyes to make us wise and to make us ready, to make us obedient from faith. He is coming at a moment we do not know. We must be ready for that. You can't get ready after he comes. That's too late. Walk in obedience and faith now. Let me pray. Lord, please fill up our hearts with an awareness, really awareness of what we so readily are familiar with, that you are returning. Fill our hearts with that, Lord. Make it sharp for us, please. Make it present and real. Lord, I don't think what I want to ask you to do, I don't know. I don't think I want to ask you to alarm us. I think resolve is the word that comes to my mind. Would you press resolve into each of your people to believe that this life is not our lives? The life that's coming is our life. Give us resolve, please. Teach us and grow us up. Give us eyes to see and hearts that long for your appearing. Give us faith to live ready for it. Build your church, Lord, please. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this message by Pastor Steve Clark of the Evangelical Free Church of Salt Lake City in Salt Lake City, Utah. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.slcevfree.org or call us directly at area code 801-943-0091. Our mailing address is Evangelical Free Church of Salt Lake City, 6515 South Lyon Lane, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84121.